Our next segment deals with what we think should rise from the ashes of the World Trade Center site. I mean, this is only our view. It's not something we wish to impose by government fiat. We have a chance to build something there even better than what was destroyed, something that will make the city even more vibrant and attractive. Shortly after the Twin Towers fell, I knew that we would have to put aside the poll issue of City Journal, which was just about to go into production, and start over. And I immediately called Frank Lozen McQuarrie, a New York and Washington architectural firm that had previously contributed much admired plans to our feature a year ago that showed how Lincoln Center, instead of spending $1.5 billion on refurbishment, could, for the same money, build an entirely new set of buildings that would be an aesthetic and acoustical improvement. And those plans got a lot of attention. Speaking for the firm today will be partner James McQuarrie.
Thank you, Myron, and thanks to City Journal. I would not be a good partner if I didn't mention my thanks and introduce my partners, Michael Frank and Arthur Lozen, both here today. And of course, the wonderful time that we had in collaboration with Alexander Stoddart and also Steve Malanga, who advised us really from the get-go on what can and what can't be done, what should and what shouldn't. So if you'll permit me the interruption here. Pardon me, sorry about that.
I think you
are
killed
the
connection.
Are we all talking here? Did I lose it? Sorry for the troubles. But while, this is Art Lozen, by the way. While we're doing that, I think that I wanted to just talk a little bit to say what a master plan is from an architect standpoint or urban planning standpoint. And that is, in fact, it's precisely the same thing that Stephen Malanga is talking about, that government's role is to establish the good political and economic conditions and transportation conditions that can make for a very good setting for development. And that's what master planning does as well, but not from an economic standpoint, but actually from a physical, you can do this now. And here's the way to do it, so that they really do follow one right after the other. And the master planning, we're having any luck?
No.
I'm very sorry.
You know, we can always do. Everybody has a copy of the journal. So if you will just get one handed up to you, you can mention
right.
What page you're referring to. We can, for a moment, go back to the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yes, that's fine. Thank you. I'm sorry. And we'll try to get this up as soon as we possibly can. And I apologize. Turning your journal to page 30, what should rise from the ashes? You'll see there Sandy Stoddart's just fantastic characterization of the skyline and the great Statue of Liberty in the foreground. That's the proposed skyline. You'll see the great buildings rising as a culmination of the New York skyline rather than the exception to the Manhattan skyline. But turn to the next page, and if you look at the master planning, the large image on your right and its predecessor, this is our proposal, its predecessor, just in the lower right-hand portion of the left-hand page, the pre-existing condition. And you'll see that, there's lots of problems there right now. And there were lots of problems before the 11th as well. And I think it's important to note that of course, what's there now is a great travesty. But there are lots of problems that still need to be fixed regardless, and should need to be fixed regardless of the events of the 11th. And that's what the master plan on the right does. So, of course, we include in our scope of work, if you will, the World Trade Center site, but we also, successful master planning isn't just coming at a particular location of 12 or 16 city blocks. If you do something here, then it's going to affect things further up the road and further down the road, and even east to west. So you'll see in the darkest shades are areas of improvements, and then the lighter shades are blocks that exist and seem to be working just fine from the city planning and urbanistic standpoint. You'll see that Battery Park City, one of the very first things we do is we suppress the West Side Highway below what is now West Street. The West Side Highway, of course, works wonderfully north of Battery Park City because there it is the edge. It's on the edge and works very, very well doing what it does. The minute it slips into Battery Park City, then it does something that's actually very, very, I think, detrimental to the city. And what it does is it divides that Battery Park City, thank you very much, gentlemen, it divides that Battery Park City from the downtown. Okay. So just to backtrack, we'll get to that.
Don't backtrack.
We won't backtrack. Thank you. What we need to do, we need to reassert the symbols of American democracy, American freedom, and resolve. Because that's what these buildings did. That's what was attacked. We need to remember the victims and sanctify that now hallowed ground. And we now need to then honor the heroes who gave their lives. The secondary goals include improving the southern Manhattan skyline and providing a richer blend of uses on the site, connecting the street grids all back through, sort of repairing, restitching the urban fabric for both traffic of vehicular trains, pedestrian access, and then, of course, building a new train station that is a dedicated train station. It's not a big office building that happens to have train access in the basement. The old plan, WTC site, was, of course, a super block, as they say. Its superness was only in its size. The surrounding buildings were comparatively low, and so that there was a really very much a very strong contrast, that the buildings were really offering themselves an exception, not only in plan, as you can see here, they're offering themselves in complete exception, in marked and intentioned contrast to the rest of the wonderful downtown. But also, as you look at them three-dimensionally, they offer themselves in stark contrast. Of course, all that was intended, but I think that history has judged those as not so good intentions. And the plaza, of course, as Stephen rightly assessed earlier, was just not a very nice place. Of course, we have the interruption in the previous condition of two major, what could be major, north-south streets and three east-west streets. And what we do here is the first thing we do is reestablish the street grid in an attempt, in the first step, of providing that set of conditions that will allow developers and allow the market forces to come and build intelligently and also be able to respond intelligently to those market forces, and also provide lots of and several opportunities, not one, not two, but several. The new tall buildings are arrayed around the Liberty Square. Liberty Square, you'll see, is just here as we're calling it. We've regridded the street. We of course, researched the historic maps, as anyone a good urban planner would do. But these are not archaeological reconstructions and repositioning of those earlier streets. We're doing things. We bring new streets in. Here's Washington Street here. West Broadway now continues all the way down. Washington Street continues all the way up. Fulton Street across. Liberty Street's down here on the bottom. This is Liberty Square. This would be the Liberty train station. We'll get to that quickly. But you provide many, 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 many opportunities for lots of different people to be involved, and that's I think, the key to the vibrancy that needs to be that needs to come back down there. Then you'll see here that West Street is a boulevard. We're picking up actually on an idea that seems to be on its way, or seems to be on its way, the boulevarding of the West Side Highway, so that in every single one of these streets ties into Battery Park City. There are a few, I think there's just a few exceptions. This one, obviously, because of the existing building, can't come through. This one doesn't come through because we have an opportunity to create a nice park, a square, if you will. In this case, it's a circus. A nice opportunity here for a great sculpture, but a great monument, and nice statue to heroes. Over here, another opportunity, and I think we might not be overstepping our bounds to suggest that it could be a great tribute to Mayor Giuliani. And of course, then we replan West Street as an avenue, and in fact, we even bring in Little West Street and extend it all the way up in here, so that it serves as a back alley, the local neighborhood street along Battery Park City. And now we go to the architecture. And flicking back and forth, you'll see the points illustrated I was making just a few minutes earlier. Here are two grand buildings. There's no doubt about it. Very, very big, colossal buildings. Big and colossal is not necessarily bad. Unfortunately, I think that they were not great buildings as statements or as architecture. New buildings, lots of new buildings. There's a density there. There's an intensity there, and that all that is very much intentional on our part. It's a marked contrast to this. Again, Sandy's drawing. And it's a beautiful color from a slightly different angle. This further down the Hudson, obviously, with the great Lady of Liberty in the foreground. And looking up, and they're getting up and looking down. Here again, before and after, you can see the urban plan, or the non-urban plan, non-urbane plan of the pre-existing. So this is a huge, it's a vast plaza. In fact, the Liberty Square they're proposing is just a bit smaller than that plaza, even though in our proposal it does comprise two city blocks. You can see it's just right there, all that connectivity all the way through vertically, up in north and south and east and west, all the way. Fulton Street now extends all the way from the East River, straight across town, all the way to the Hudson. You can see these buildings act, they conspire with each other in doing lots of things. One is giving a nice edge, a nice identity to this square. That's goal number one. Goal number two is crescendo, so that you culminate in very big tall buildings here and here. On the north side, we feel very strongly that the taller buildings should be arranged here in order to allow the south light in. Of course, this building, these are all in the 60s and 70s and 80s in terms of stories. The train station is six or seven stories tall, and four or five stories down is the low level, which actually does make it a very tall building, but a lot of it is below ground. A nice dome that would light all of that space down is, as I said again, a dedicated train station. It's low height, and you can see the minimal shadow that it casts into the park. It emits light, lots of light, into the square, so that this is not going to be, even though these spaces are, the buildings are tall, it's not going to be a tight, dark, dank place. It's going to be an absolutely magnificent square. Thank you. And just to give you all a sense of what this could look and feel like. All the buildings have great tops.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Here's Liberty Square, very quickly. And I'll let Sandy get into this. This is really his ground. But just urbanistically, The only street that doesn't get, that doesn't have the permission to travel east and west all the way through is Day Street, D-E-Y. Right now it's one block long, I think. Of course, the reason why it doesn't continue is that we can make a grand Memorial Square. Here are two bridges, one here and one here, so that those, as one drives past on, say, Broadway, a block to the east along here, as you look west, everyone's experience as you drive down any of the north-south avenues, you look west and there's that great space beyond, and it's that view west that is so sort of poetic and beautiful about the New York experience. Here, though, we have bridges, so that even though you're not in the square, you're outside the square, you're further out into the city, here these bridges indicate that something particularly important is going on right here in this state. Train station again here. Great Pine buildings up on the top. So now we're going to take you down from where we were, take you down into the square. And this is where I'm going to turn it over to Sandy. A very early character sketch. And now I give you the mind and person of Alexander Sauter.
For more than a year, the chorus of praise from discerning architecture and art critics for a young Scottish sculptor named Alexander Sauter has been growing louder. And right now, Sandy Sauter is becoming an art world star. His more than life-size statue of John Witherspoon has just been dedicated at Princeton, and his sculptural friezes for Buckingham Palace and for the New Oxford University, one's in progress, one's just been completed, and they're causing a lot of excitement in Britain. By a very strange coincidence, even before September 11th, he had already been thinking about a memorial to New York City employees lost in the line of duty. After September 11th, he produced a beautiful moving design for a monument that he'll tell you about now. We did not plan the bagpipe, but it's fortuitous to produce Sandy Sauter.
Thank you, Myron. Ladies and gentlemen, if I speak like this, can you all hear me? Yeah, everything's clear.
Good. Can they understand you?
Making the statue of John Witherspoon in Basingstoke, where it was being cast in Hampshire. That's Old Hampshire in England, the foundry there. While I was down at the foundry attending to the final chasing of the statue when the day of cataclysm arrived, just shortly after. And I found the hard men of the foundry down there with their skinhead haircuts and earrings through every protruding part of their faces. You know, pretty tough lot, really. Their feelings about the statue had changed radically, for it wasn't just some old fella who had gone to America, whose identity they weren't sure of anymore. Because of what had happened in America, they were all growing highly wistful about this statue in the foundry. It comes to Princeton now not merely as a heritage work, but as a work of consolidation and a statement that the affinities between the Scots and the Americans are now redoubled. I'm honoured to be able to convey that message to you. And shortly after that, Frank, Lewis and McCrary were on to me on the phone about how to build a shrine. It's a taxing thing for the modern age to try to do, for it was an age that rather got short of reverence. And consequently, we undertook a long tour of duty in deconstruction, irreverence, and I should say, shoddy mode of life in respect of remembering the dead, the last unemancipated social group in the modern age. So it seems clear to me that in the very first instance, what we must do is establish in this place a statement, not an interpretation, not a development, not some sort of stylish exegesis, but simply a categorical statement of fact of the image of those who died, I was greatly advised in this matter by people that I'm working with, because I understand my distance from this, that I should confine the design to representations, at least at the mortal level, of firemen and policemen. They are the mean term in this time of war between the civilian and the military, and they lean that way. I recommended, and still recommend, that the idiom for this kind of image should be in the heroic realist style. It's a style that the Americans excelled in. You have the finest example of it in this country, which stands under the title The Shrine of Democracy in South Dakota. That's the real name for the Rushmore Monument, and it must be, in fact, the finest work of heroic realism on the planet. Americans do it well. You understand, I have to be seriously advised when it comes to representing the sartorials of these people. I scour the pages of the Glasgow Herald and the Scotsman, the other newspaper in Scotland that comes from Edinburgh, to see what cops wear in America. And of course, a varying account, and we could hardly see through the smoke and dust of the photographs. Nothing was clearly set out. But this can all be looked into by the sculptor. If it's me, I don't know, it might not be, who does these works. But a policeman and a fireman, they represent the heroic act of intention to go into the inferno. Now, at the other end of the square stands a redemptive, non-representational object, an object that transcends the facts of the catastrophe and seeks to represent something in absolute polar opposition to the effect that we can see now down at Ground Zero. In short, the conversion of an appalling sight of carnage and twisted metal and contortion, the replacement of that by a thing that frankly attains towards some stability and an appeal to the forms of beauty. The style of the work, in the figure work at least, it belongs really to the Beaux-Arts classical tradition, the classical Beaux-Arts tradition, which is so well represented in New York. And in fact, of course, New York also has the very finest work of Beaux-Arts sculpture on the planet. It's in the often overlooked Statue of Liberty, a work of, I should say, almost perfect art. I studied it for many years, and there is not a view that fails. Auguste Bartholdi, they made it. And in this work, appeal is made to the statue. The statue functions as a sort of Tyche, that is, a civic deity that stands not only to protect the city of New York, but also the whole of the country of America, and also so many of the aspirations of the West as they were set up in the age of the Atlantic revolutions, when the idea of living free from fear was rather first mooted. Well, not first mooted, but put into big plan. You can see that these two figures here, your right, goddess of memory holding a torch aloft, and Cleo, muse of history, holding the tablet, they assemble over this void two of the key attributes of the Statue of Liberty herself. They are, as it were, little sisters of the Statue of Liberty. Mnemosyne, of course, is the mother of the Muses, signifying that the Greeks, who were profoundly clever people, knew that artistry derives directly from memory, and that a people that is forgetful is more than likely to be a highly Philistine people. Above, the torch is held out so as to inform something of the quality of that day's terrible results without slavish representation of them, which I mean to say is the representation of distance and fall on a vertical axis. The axis proceeds right down and goes through a catafalque that sits between the two piers of the plinth. The plinth, as you can see, are fluted at the top to connote the change of the facing detail on the twin towers without making slavish representation of them. The catafalque lies between to signify the fact that in this empty tomb, the idea of the, as it were, those who are deprived of decent burial space can have symbolic rest here. And beneath that further, there is a further cut dug into the pavement. And that cut is really the mean term between the monument's account of the work and our experience of it, for it is in our territory, and yet it is integrated into the monument. I think it was, I find it strange to invoke this here, but Hegel, a philosopher for whom a great deal has to be, at whose door a great deal has to be laid, talked greatly about syntheses, the idea of antithesis, opposed by synthesis, forming, opposed by thesis, forming synthesis. And this hole, this umbriferous hole in the pavement that will be gridded and stepped down into the ground, seems to signify the point of oracular questioning, where people, where we, ask why into the void, and all our perplexities as it were called. The stylobate of the monument is there to form an adequate shelf for the flowers that people will hopefully always put upon this thing. If you worry that that cut will become scruffy and occupied by itinerants, never worry, for cities such as this are capable of maintaining their precincts and seeing that their shrines are clean. I think for the process of time, we may just stop here now, and then we can take questions or statements as required. Thank you.
Wonderful. The microphone is open. Chuck Brody.
Points. One, as people often given on West Street, you're saying we ought to depress lower part. The original plan of Battery Park City was to have that go up all the way and have really the grandest plaza in the history of the world, as Nick often given to that. And second, the other one is that the original cost of the landfill of Battery Park City was $120 million. Market value before the incident was $6 billion. Why not just extend another quarter of a mile, half a mile landfill and put all the rubble from the disaster over there?
It could be. I think a lot of the material is being removed from the island. Those are decisions that I think needed to have been made earlier. And also, it was a different time then. I think, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of Battery Park City is rubble that was removed, and as you say, it was in a landfill in the old port. Now we have EPA, and we have restrictions and study of environmental impact studies that take years and years and years. And of course, I think what's being done down there now is wholly appropriate. First order is to get the thing cleaned up. If another time we would have very intelligently, or I say very carefully and appropriately, put it in the river, but I think those days have passed. As for elevating of the West Side Highway, elevation has worked. The problem with elevation, we want to put it down, and the reason why there's already a culture of tunnels on that southern end of this fine island, and that's our view, is to extend that the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, the South End Tunnel, and I think to have one elevated and then have to slip down, the process of elevation costs a lot of real estate as far as interconnectivity, the process of suppressing of tunneling, I think costs as far as space less.
I don't think you have to change the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel at all.
No, I don't think you have to.
I think his point is that what he wants to do is take the West Side Highway and dig a tunnel under West Street. So the West Side Highway will go underneath West Street, and West Street will be a boulevard on the Park Avenue right. model, so that there is so that Battery Park City now is connected to the rest of the city. The World Financial Center connected to the rest of the city, and that multi-use residential and commercial 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week neighborhood that we think would bring the most vitality to the city can really flourish there under those circumstances. Judge Crozet.
My memory over the last few decades is that sculpture in plazas and so forth tended to be uniformly abstract, pieces of metal, a lot of the time rusted metal. Is there a trend away from that and into the representational kinds of things, or are you a voice in the wilderness?
Well, it's always extremely attractive to be a voice in the wilderness, but I fear it's becoming daily more peopled. There has been a call for abstractionism to be taken here in this case, and in fact over in Britain, the papers have been full of observations how the lying fragment of the skin of the building that sits there at that atrocious angle should, as it were, looking so very much like a piece of modern sculpture, therefore recommend itself as a piece of modern sculpture. But I feel that that cannot be tolerated, for this is a test case of that sort of deconstruction. One would simply ask, to whom does one attribute the design of this monument if it is to look like that? And we cannot have our monuments designed by zealots and warmongers, if you understand what I mean. This is the problem of deconstruction, that it has a nihilism and a fundamental negativity. I work against that, and have done so largely in the wilderness, but always with a mass following. In other words, the mandarins will have nothing to do with me, but the rank and file of people queue at the studio door.
Starting with the Queen, which is a useful thing.
From the Queen up.
From the Queen up.
I'm George Selden, just a citizen of the City of New York. I have basically a question. My inference is that the City Journal commissioned this particular study. How many other studies are afoot, and who ultimately will pass judgment as to which study will prevail?
Well, there are a gazillion studies afoot, and the jockeying about who will make the decision, as you can imagine, especially now that the mayoral race is over, is proceeding fast and furiously all over the city, all over the state, and extending even down to Washington, as our senators meet with our city government and our state government and so on up the line. So there's as many cooks as can be imagined just now, and which of them will finally season the broth remains to be seen, and that's why Steve Malanga has put forward his suggestions about the clear kind of model that would work best for making sure that whatever is chosen is both appropriate and something that will vitalize the city rather than freeze or kill it.
Neil Sullivan, it's been about, I think, about 25 years since the cement truck fell through the West Side Highway. Is there any way of combining, finishing, or doing something with the West Side Highway in conjunction with everything else?
By saying doing something with it, do you mean getting rid of
this,
it? Or?
No, these are major plans for downtown, yes. And for New York City, not only downtown.
I think, Neil, that note that I was fascinated to read, I think in the New York Times, something that my recollection is 25 years ago was not what they were saying, that one of the great missed opportunities of New York was the building of Westway, and wouldn't it be fabulous if we had that depressed highway with the park right out onto the river, with those, in those days, I think it was only hundreds of millions of dollars, or, you know, it was over $1 billion of federal government money. Would that they had been saying that loudly every day 25 years ago, when one zealous activist, Ms. Benstock, managed to stop what would have been the greatest infrastructure amenity we can imagine. Now there's no money. You know, the feds are not, it's not even on the table. It doesn't mean that it isn't still a great, great idea.
Yeah. Can I ask one other question? The with the architectural plans, the World Trade Center was many things. One of them was it was a huge mall, and it was very pedestrian friendly. And there was, for pedestrians, means of going through the World Trade Center without streets going through.
Right.
And in the new plans, is there any pedestrian-friendly locations or I use the word mall, whatever you want to call it, but pedestrian-friendly areas in these plans?
Well, I think it's one of the failings of the critique of urbanism over the last 50 years or so, that streets are necessarily pedestrian unfriendly. The streets are actually pedestrian. It happens that we're able to also use them for cars. This is the most pedestrian city in the United States of America. And I'll go to my grave insisting that. I think, first and foremost, a pedestrian city. Of course, then, I think, so rather than just disagree with your premise, I will also respond by saying that traffic subsides on streets that don't run through. And that was also one of our sort of very subtle elements of day streets not continuing through. Because we don't want this Liberty Square setting for Sandy's great sculptures to be packed with honking horns and people really upset, but really rather a place for citizens in their shoes to interact with the city and interact with these monuments. So the Day Street doesn't run through, which means that there won't be a whole heck of a lot of traffic, vehicular traffic, on the square, on the perimeter streets on the square. Rather, people will go to Fulton Street and use it as a main cross, and go down to Liberty and use it as a main cross. Cabs will figure it all out in a minute.
So the thought is that square will end up being downtown's analog to Bryant Park.
Yes.
And all that mall life that you speak of will happen outside, and there will be, sandwich shops selling people lunches, which they'll take into the square there, and that there will be, we hope, a vibrant community there, because these buildings that Franklos and McCreary suggest will end up increasing the density of that area by about 50%. So there will actually be more offices and apartments there than what were there with the 210 story towers, and that therefore there is opportunity for the kind of street life that Jane Jacobs loved and that we all love New York for, where lots and lots is going on. Richard Aspinwall, I think we have to stop now and take a 10-minute break, and then we'll promptly reassemble. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yes.